Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another Crime and Science Radio. Turning the tables, however, where Emmy-winning investigative reporter Hank Philip P. Ryan is going to interrogate Jan Burke. So you're going to go a little bit more just about your host. And then in 2 weeks, Crime and Science Radio will be back, and Hank Philip P. Ryan will put Doug Lyle in the hot seat, talking to him also and interviewing. So we got two great shows for you coming up. But first, we want to let you know that our shows this month are sponsored by New American Library, the publisher of the book Somebody I Used to Know by Ted Bell, who Nelson DeMille and Suspense Magazine praised as one of the best crime fiction writers going on right now. So make sure you check out the book Somebody I Used to Know by author Ted Bell. And, of course, always check out our other sponsors, Kensington Publishing, KensingtonBooks.com, for all the great things that they have going on. Lisa Jackson, Kevin O'Brien, Shane Yerke, The Fury has just come out. So make sure that you go and support our sponsors and check all of them out. You can find all those books, of course, on Amazon.com, where I suggest you go buy, because Amazon's got everything. So without any further ado, let's jump in now to our show, where we have Hank Philip P. Ryan interviewing Jan Burke, or should I say interrogating Jan Burke.
I'm meeting Philip E. Ryan, and we're turning the tables a bit today. Jan Burke, one of your hosts here on Crime and Science Radio, today is in the interviewee seat, so a new role for you, Jan. You have, 2 years now of these terrific programs, and we figured it was about time for the hosts to get a chance to be in the spotlight. So we'll have Doug Lyle coming up in a week or so, but today you kick it off. We're happy to have you here being interviewed.
Well, thank you for taking on this role, Hank. I couldn't be in better hands. Thank you.
Well, it's fun. You have such a double life as an Edgar-winning author, a fiction, and also a forensic science activist, and we'll talk about both today. But first, a little bit about you. Where did you grow up? What were you like as a kid? What was your life like?
Well, I was just thinking today, in fact, of the sort of adventurous childhood I had in a lot of ways. I was born in Houston, Texas. We lived there until I was, about halfway through first grade when we came to California. And I've lived here all of my life since then. So that was in 1960. So a long-time California resident, but I still have a lot of family in Texas and other parts of the South and Midwest and really all over the place, but California's been home. So I grew up here mostly in Garden Grove, California, Los Alamitos, sort of Orange County for those who are familiar with the area. Moved over to Long Beach for college, and, you know, that's sort of up to early adulthood. If I were to name major events, then would undoubtedly include the death of my mother when I was 12. I think that's impacted my fiction in a lot of ways, as well as my life in general. And my dad remarried. I have a really, we call her mom, wonderful stepmother, who took on, well, my older sister was out of the house by then and married, but she took on raising the three of us who were younger. So that's
well, you can see all those influences in your books. It's so revealing to hear the real life jam behind Irene's life, even. But how did you see the world as a child? Did you think every door would open for you? Did you think life would be a challenge? What were your dreams growing up?
Well, I was interested, I think having a father who was very much a do-it-yourself, fix-it type, who, although he had very traditional ideas about women and their roles, he married strong women in both his marriages. His mother was a very strong woman. And when he would be working on cars and doing other things around the house or working with, tools, building things or whatever, he totally allowed his daughters to be in on it. So I would be there handing him things and learning how things work. So it was sort of this mixed message of you can do anything, but girls should do X, Y, and Z. Fortunately, the latter half of that message didn't take very well. I also had a big make-believe world, as I suppose most kids who grew up to be writers do. I was the kid who told everybody, you know, we're going to do this play, and you're going to be this person, and you're going to be that person, or we're going to pretend this, and I would assign everyone their roles and set up the situation and go. So bossy and creative. So I had, siblings that we were close as a family, so we spent a lot of time together, did a lot of creative play, not as much, there was television, but we didn't spend a lot of time watching it. We were outside a lot. To me, looking back, although it had its share of tragedies, in many ways it was an idyllic childhood. We were allowed to do all kinds of crazy, dangerous things.
I know. How did we even survive, right, back then?
Even the monkey bars, when you stop and think about the monkey bars, how did we
ride? Not to mention riding in the back of the station wagon. Oh, my goodness. And I have to confess to you, we have a strange connection. I was vice president of the Midwest chapter of the National Beatles fan club. So I laughed when I read about your Beatles connection.
Yes. Well, I suppose any girl who, was alive during that time and, the Beatles were it, so, yeah.
And what were you president of what?
Well, we had the Skylark Elementary School Beatle Lovers of America, and there was not much of an organization to it, just a group of us that used to walk around together at recess, and at that time, there were a lot of magazines designed for teenagers, supposedly, but I think probably really aimed for preteens like we were. And so we'd walk around at recess, and if you, managed to smuggle in a copy of Tiger Beat or something to your class, you would share that during recess. And I remember my mother once, sort of giving in on all this. She thought it was hilarious and buying me a special Beatles tribute mag of some kind that was not seen everywhere. And so I was, really high on myself that day at recess.
My mother threw all of my Beatle magazines away. We would be so wealthy if we had just kept those. Did you read as a kid, though? Were you? I did plays, too. That's so funny that we have these parallel childhoods. Did you read a lot? Not just Tiger Beat, but books?
Right. There were lots of books in the house, and my parents were both readers, so I had a great example. And my mother, we were like, I think, a lot of... when I was a young child, we didn't have a lot of money. We weren't poor. My mother had really come from, and actually my father too, from poverty. So we were sort of lower middle class, I'd say, at that point. Really struggling, but, three kids, young parents. And you could go into a store, used to have these whole sections, I don't know if they still do, of toys for kids, cheap things. And, we would want those, but But my mother would say no to that. But if you, we learned quickly that if you ask for a book, you could get the book. So little golden books, you know, all through school, and then later in the schools, we had the Scholastic Book Program, so we would order books that way. My mother started a school library at my school. Taught me a whole lesson with volunteers. I don't know if you want to get into all that, but basically she started our school library. So I grew up with people who love books.
What a treasure that is. I mean, when you think about that now, those kinds of things that happen in our formative years that turn out to be what your whole life is.
Well, you know, she was told there's no money for a library, there's no space for a library, there's no budget to buy books, it just can't be done. And she was the president of the PTA. She got, the teachers at the school thought it was a good idea. They gave up their break room and said, you can turn that into the school library. And
you know,
so she got volunteers from the PTA to donate books and to staff the library during school hours. So these mothers would sit in there and teachers could send students into the library. And we learned essentially as elementary school children what libraries were and all of that from that experience. And I don't listen to no as an answer.
Well, you know, what a hero she was. To so many kids. And we'll talk about the Kwanwab project later, but you have to admit that, you know, sort of taking something from nothing and making it work and changing the world, and we'll talk about this in a bit, but the Kwanwab project that you did is very analogous to what your mom did with the library.
Thank you.
That's amazing. So you went off to college and majored in history, which, of course, is storytelling as well. What was it that lured you to history?
Well, history, there's so many reasons I love history. History, in part, teaches us who we are, and so I think that has always appealed to me, the identity that you can find in history. Why are things now as the way they are? Well, look back to what they were. Why do we think as we do? Why do some of us think in one way and others in another, and you look at the culture you've shared and the history you've shared, and it has this huge influence. Also, history is really, and one of the parts of it I always just really loved, is the research is essentially detective work. You're looking into the business of dead people. You're deciding what evidence is reliable, what evidence is significant, what is just kind of leading you astray. So all of those things are part of it for me. I learned so much about research skills that have been invaluable to me in later life. It's why it's a great major, even if you don't end up doing history, because it can teach you how to find out things. To this day, if there's a difficult question to be Googled, my husband turns to me. He knows that I'll, you know, in part, history teaches you how to frame the question so that you can get the information you want. So all that was invaluable. And then, of course, just our stories. And it is storytelling. It's taking all of that and then telling a story with it, and it's also listening to other people's stories. I did a lot of that because I was involved in all of history. So
that's, I mean, what I love about this is seeing sort of the puzzle pieces of your life come together sort of inexorably to do what you do. I mean, here's research and psychology and motivation and storytelling and detective work. And your mother with her love of books and libraries, and, you know, you can just see how you turned out the way you turned out, you know, with your curiosity and your determination. Was there a moment when you thought, you know, I'm going to write fiction, I'm going to write a detective story? What was that moment? How did that happen?
Well, I knew at 7 years old that I wanted to write. I was just the child and the influence by people who couldn't picture that as a living.
What do you mean?
To this day, I think, although he's proud of me now, I don't think my father sees the arts in any form as something people really do as a living. They're, the H word, as we call it, for anyone who is an artist, the hobby word, you know.
Oh,
that's a
really?
Nice hobby. That's a nice hobby. But you'll starve in a cold Soho apartment, you know. You'll paper the walls with rejection letters. It's, you know, it's sort of not something that you should ever think of, you know, it's not practical. And I think there are a lot of people out there, so if any of you are in wanting to write, let me just say to you, be impractical. Go ahead. You're not going to be able to stop yourself anyway.
What did you say to your father when he would say that?
Well, I, you know, at that point, you know, and especially, you know, after my mother was sort of the positive influence, and my father was the critical person. And as bad as the critical thing can be, I have to say I also feel it plays its role. You know, it's not too bad to learn how to get over your bad self.
On the
other hand, it can also be paralyzing. And so, you know, he did, you know, he wanted, in, it was his way of being a loving person, you know, was to be critical. I don't want to make it sound like he was this unforgiving person. He certainly was, and he accepted human frailty and all that. He wasn't, you know, just a terribly harsh, but he was more likely to be the voice that said, that won't work, than the one.
So why did you think it would? What made you go on and write that first novel? How did you overcome that? Why did you decide to do it?
Part of it was probably an innate rebelliousness that he, I think, in part gave to me, whether he realizes it or not.
Huh.
But partly that, and partly that, during those years of doing history, I interviewed women who worked in aircraft plants, resin derivatives. And I couldn't have had a greater gift than that would be a 20-something talking to people. The youngest person I think I interviewed was in her late 50s. I mean, the oldest ones were almost 80.
Uh-huh.
And I began to see, you know, I'm not necessarily the most insightful person, but it was pretty obvious that you could put them in two rough camps. That people who told their life stories by saying, I always wanted to, if only, I wish I had. And the people who said, you know, I may not be playing Carnegie Hall, but I love the violin, so I'm going to play the violin. And he just never let people stop them. And some of them were up against huge odds for succeeding at things, but they just tried the things they wanted to try and did the things they wanted to do. So without going into all the history of my strange work history, essentially I was managing a manufacturing plant, making good money, and just hated putting my shoes on because it was the last thing I had to do before going out the door. And I had been riding along, and basically my husband was the only person seeing stuff. But nothing very serious, nothing very long. And one day I just thought, you know, you're going to end up in that camp of people who said I always wanted to if you don't make an effort. If you want to be 80 and on your, you know, at that time, you know, if I want to be sitting around saying, I wish I had written that novel. So yeah, I mean, at that point I thought, you better try to do this.
And I know, and it's been such a life-changing thing, and your Irene Kelly and your other books, but your Irene Kelly is such an icon now. in mystery crime fiction. Of course, I love reading books where the main character is a reporter. But where did she come from? She's such a real person. She's so honorable and so loyal and so courageous and so smart. Where did she come from in your brain?
Well, you know, she came in many ways from a smoky dive in L.A. My husband's a and we were out one night and watching some friends dance late, and some very big women got up to dance. So this was in the late 80s, and the Jane Fonda workout change was out, and people were meeting in aerobics class. And that, if you want to find the body-conscious capital of the world, I challenge you to do better than the west side of L.A. This group of really big women got up and danced and just was having a great time. And the first line of Goodnight Irene came to me, which was, he loved to watch fat women dance. And I did literally turn to my husband at that moment and say, I just had a first line come to me, and if I don't make use of this, I'm going to stop saying that I'm going to write a book one day. And that
first line has just changed crime fiction history, hasn't it? I mean, everybody talks about it. Everyone loves it. It's unbelievably original and unique and realistic.
Well, for me, it was strange because I sort of knew immediately that it was a eulogy. In an odd way, it was someone talking about someone. That line was about someone who was gone. That line was about someone who had meant something to her. And this is another piece of advice that I think I've heard other writers give in teaching situations, and I think it's a really great one, which is that if you're reading books and something is missing for you from them, then that's a clue to you to go after that and write about that thing that you're not seeing, that you wish was there. And I had read a lot of crime fiction, but I hadn't seen grief. And I wanted to write about someone who felt that grief, but who wasn't disabled by it, wasn't paralyzed by it. It would hit her in a real way, and the reader would be aware of it. And so you only know O'Connor because she remembers him. He's dead on page 2. I'm not just spoiling anything, folks, really.
But I mean, it's interesting because that focus on having your character, and she starts off very cocky, and then she changes. She what happens to her in all the books affects her. Was that important to you?
It was really important to me. I wanted, something I was looking for from the beginning was for the books to, I wanted there to be something emotionally true about them. And I had a friend who had been attacked in her home by an escaped convict. And I thought about her and other victims of violence I knew, and by the time I was writing the next book, I knew that I didn't want a character who wasn't affected by the violence she experienced. And it just became important to me to say to people like my friend that, there's a certain courage that comes in going out the front door after you've had an experience that makes you want to just never venture out again, So, I had seen so many books in which there had been, somebody had experienced violence, and either if they were hard-boiled, they just knocked back a shot of whiskey and got right on back out there, and all they were concerned with was having Adam again. And then I saw the other ones where it was just sort of part of a puzzle. You know, it didn't even emotionally affect anybody anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It's just something, a logic problem, we were all going to joke about it, in fact. There's a place for all that kind of stuff, and it is it plays an important role for our genre, I think, to have that variety out there.
I mean, you were you started writing Irene, what, in 1993?
So published then, yes. I was writing in the 90s.
So that was pretty early, you know, in the women author world. You were pretty groundbreaking when it came to writing violence and about violence. I mean, she has to cope with this. She has to examine her fears. Your books don't hold back from that.
You know, I appreciate you saying that. There were other people certainly before me. You know, I wasn't... Maxine O'Callaghan, Marsha Muller, Sarah Presti, Sue Grafton, they had already, you know, and some people before them as well that we tend not to remember, but there have been women writing in the harder boiled end of things with modern feminist detectives, but I wasn't. For me, what I wasn't finding yet, I'm not saying it didn't happen along the way with many, many other people, but I wanted someone who was connected to other people, who wasn't really a lone wolf, because it seemed to me that my life and the lives of many of the other women I knew were complicated by that. So huh. I wanted that complication to be a presence in her life. The other thing was just what you're saying about violence. In fact, when the second book came out, I had a bookseller say to me that, you know, it had bothered her that it was so violent. And I pointed out that the same bookseller had praised books by men that were just as violent, if not more so, and that in fact sure. one of her favorite authors was someone who had people, you know, suffer excruciating injuries, and she said, well, I guess I'm just not, I just don't expect that from a woman. And I said, I went out of the girls' school, you know.
I went out of the girls' school. I think you should make a bumper sticker. out of it. It's, I mean, your newest book, your newest Irene, is Disturbance, correct? Which is about reinvention, sort of.
Yes.
Would you say, which you have done yourself? So talk about that book just a bit, and then I want to go on to this other part of your life.
Well, you know, I started writing the series. The newspapers were still alive and well. There were, I mean, the internet existed for a few people out there, but most people were not yet online. They were, that was sort of just hatching around the time my first book came out in terms of a widespread public phenomenon. There was no web yet. So it was a different world. And it was a world I was fascinated with. But as I've had the pleasure of getting to know reporters and hanging out in newsrooms and so on, I also saw, of course, how those times changed and how difficult that became for a lot of them. And I realized that, you know, at some point, a paper the size of Irene's and in the situation it was in and in the place it was in was really unlikely to survive. And I thought, well, how would she cope with that? And at the same time, you know, near the time I was writing that, people started having to deal with that in the economy. You know, the market, you know, went south, and a whole lot of people were having to reinvent themselves. So I just started thinking about that. I started thinking about how we define ourselves, how our work defines us, how we sometimes need to step back and see that the universe is a bigger place for us. So,
I mean, and haven't you done that so perfectly with your Crime Lab project? I mean, talk about seeing the the way the universe revolves and how everything we do affects something else, and you're caring about the victims of violence and facing violence, and your image of being able to walk out the front door. You may walk into a situation where law enforcement is trying to solve this violence and they can't do it.
Well, I think the shock for me as I began doing research was that I realized that we had all these fantastic advancements and tools, DNA being just one of them. But let's take that as the prime example, since most people are familiar with it, that the technology is there, the machinery has been invented, there's nothing missing except the funding to the labs to ensure that you have the facilities to do this. So I was teaching a class with Barry Fisher, who was at that time head of scientific services for the LA Sheriff's Department, and the homicide detective, Beth Smith, was an L.A. Sheriff's Department homicide detective, and we taught a class together for mystery writers, and I was sort of trying to help writers combine all of these different aspects of the reality in the fiction. And someone asked, how long does it take to get DNA back? Now, this was probably in about 2000 or so. And the answer came back, we hope we have it ready in time for trial. And now this is Los Angeles. We're not talking about a small, county that's struggling to pave its roads. Well, we are, but
we're
not talking about a small rural county or someplace where there aren't a lot of resources. There are resources here. And I started exploring that, and I realized that not just in Los Angeles, but in much of the country, DNA was not being used to solve rapes and murders. It was being used at trial to help obtain a conviction. And they hoped, by the time they ran it, something else was homicide detectives. Elizabeth Smith said, we hope we have the right guy at that point. That the test doesn't.
What was in your heart at that moment?
I just thought of the victims. I thought of their families. I thought of the detectives, the frustration level, to know that you're going to be essentially using 19th century methods to solve crime. You're going to be going out knocking on doors, and all the intense work and, frankly, danger of doing that, and the time consumed to use that method, and as I've gone on and learned more about the fallibility of eyewitness and confession, this gets complicated, when you start to become concerned with the innocent as well.
When we talk about the rape kit backlog and the problems with coroners and the basic, just incredibly underfunded crime labs, and you realize that this is not just paperwork, but, this is people's lives and freedom at stake.
Right, and I also realized that nobody was really free to talk about it, because the chief of police does not want you going out and saying that the lab can't do its job. And that's who you work for if you're in most labs. So somebody needed to get the word out, and I thought my colleagues and I are presenting a false picture here of how things are. We present a world where all this functions perfectly, and it's so far from that. It truly isn't funny. So I thought I'll ask my colleagues to help spread the word that this needs to be fixed, and they've stepped up to do that.
So what's the status of it now? You have this fabulous website, fabulous fundraising, incredible blogs that talk about advances in DNA and the problem with funding and the decertification of crime labs and, you know, every element of how science is being thwarted by finances.
Right. I mean, basically, what we try to do, because, we're not, I don't want to portray this as being, you know, like organized like the Red Cross or something. We are, we're pretty loose-knit. And basically, our goal has been education first, because there's still so many people who don't realize what the situation is. And I think, you know, we've made some strides, and we've helped to bring attention to the problem, and we hope to keep doing that. We have a Twitter feed is probably one of the easiest ways for people. If you just at Crime Lab Project, if you follow that, you will get news stories, links to news stories that are happening. You know, we usually put up five a day is the average of links to stories about forensic science. As you mentioned, we have the website. We also have a Facebook page. But mainly we just are asking anybody who's interested, you know, become informed. And then, you know, the way, because we are broken up into so many different jurisdictions, a lot of this is local. So a lot of this means, you know, find out what's going on in your local area. Find out what the situation is there. Don't take the, you know, public information officers about that for the answer, you know, really find out what's going on. And, you know, one of the places where we have the biggest problem right now is death investigations. We are letting deaths be investigated by people who have no background in forensic science, no background in medicine, no background in the law. They're elected or appointed. In most places, if you're 18 and you don't have a felony conviction and you've lived in the place for a year, you could be the coroner. So it brings business to undertakers in a lot of places. But in the meantime, the rest of us, we're not finding out why we're dying. And if you stop and think about it, that's a really dangerous situation to be in. Only thing we know about dead people is that their hearts aren't beating, so every death certificate says coronary, you know. We fund heart research, but maybe we should be looking at other things. You know, so it affects us from a public health level, public safety, and of course it affects our criminal justice system incredibly.
I mean, anyone who's interested in crime fiction at all will be fascinated by the crime facts and the reality that you explained so beautifully in your blog and website and Facebook page about what's happening in real detective work and real crime solving. We only have a couple more minutes, so quickly, just for the incredibly meta portion of this interview. This radio show, usually you're in the interview seat with the amazing Doug Lyle, Dr. Doug Lyle. How did that start?
Doug and I had talked for years about doing a radio show about forensic science. Doug, you know, and I always joke that, you know, he started out with his side of things because I needed newsletter articles when I was president of the SoCal chapter. So we formed a friendship back in those days and have been mutually involved with forensic science and different areas of it for a long time. And we said, you know, really, we should bring our it's a nice balance because I was working more with policy things and meeting people who were involved in sort of the delivery of services, I'll say. Doug was, you know, advising writers, so he had helped just about anybody you can name, myself included, you know, to get it right.
Oh, me too, absolutely.
Yeah, so we realized a lot of people between us, and we eventually realized that neither of us wanted to have a fourth or fifth career as radio producers, but we were aware of John Robb over at Suspense Magazine, and Doug approached John, I think, with the idea, it has been a couple of years ago now, and we we found it was a perfect fit, and John's been really great about helping us to do something. Like I said, we talked about it for a long time, but we didn't have our act together around the production side of it. So John has helped us out tremendously with that, and does a great job of getting the word out about the show. So we have this podcast now, and I have to say to people, if you want to hear somebody who has expertise in the U.S., we have had some of the most amazing forensic scientists, and some fabulous writers, yourself included.
Thank you.
Among them, you know, so really fascinating people. You know, I love the program we did with you on investigative reporting. So it's really a chance to talk to people who are looking at criminal investigations, forensic science, and all of these things together from a variety of angles. And, you know, so it's a great resource, we think, not just for writers, but for anybody in the public who's interested.
And they're archived, right? So you can look at them forever.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Dan, you're such a connector. You know, you bring people together and share information and educate and make changes and entertain your readers and winning the Edgar along the way. Just wrapping up here, are you surprised by how your life has turned out?
You know, I am, but you know, it's something I have to always tell myself is that it's a good thing I don't care what I planned for, you know. in many areas of my life, you know, there are things I've wished or longed for or thought I did, you know, and then life took another turn and I got something just so much better. So you know, sometimes when you hit a rough patch, it's good to remember that there might be a nice surprise around the corner. So.
Yeah. You have such a wonderful story, Jan Brooks. Thank you so much for being on your own radio show today.
Thank
and we'll
you.
Be listening in the weeks coming up. Thanks so much.
Thank you.